If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
In 2007, we made a wine together and we decided to call it Chester's Anvil, which fit in perfectly with our motto, get hammered on the anvil. Although we could have called it Chester's Plow and then it could have been get plowed on the plow, but it didn't have the same ring to it.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 462. This week we feature Linda Neal, owner of Tierra Roja in Napa Valley. It really is something to see how just under 5 acres off of Silverado Trail in Napa Valley can produce some really excellent wine. That's Tierra Roja. Linda Neal owns Tierra Roja, and for this 2021 vintage, she's debuting her new winemaker, Benoit Touquet. Linda has been a dear friend for many years, and I was able to join her for her 2018 vintage release dinner at the Las Vegas Country Club 2 weeks ago. Not only did invited guests get to taste the new vintage, but 2011, 2012, 2013, and 2014 as well. How's that for good luck in Las Vegas? You can also hear Linda on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term suckering. Today we are in Las Vegas for the first live interview in many months with our very dear friend, Linda Neal of Tierra Roja. How are you, Linda?
I am doing just great, Ray. It's so good to see you.
It's good to see you in person after all this crazy year that have gone by. And I should say we're in Las Vegas here for you to introduce your new wine and as well as to be able to taste some older wines.
Yes, we're going to have a really fun event tonight. We're going to start off with the brand new 2018, and then we're going to have 4 different vintages with dinner tonight. So it'll be a lot of fun, especially since Chef Fred Coleman has created such a wonderful menu to go with it.
We were at this event a few years ago, and it was just a great time. To be able to taste these different vintages, to me, is just one of the most fun things to do. 18, though, is kind of a special year, isn't it? I mean, that was a kind of a bumper crop for Napa, generally speaking. Was it for you, or...?
Well, it was a good harvest. It wasn't by any means our largest harvest, nor our smallest. It was just a good harvest, and one that the wines are just turning out spectacular. I've been here in Las Vegas introducing the wine since Wednesday to a lot of the fine restaurants that carry it here, and I have never had a warmer reception from the sommeliers than I have had with this 2018 vintage. It's been amazing.
That's nice. It's got to be pretty cool to be able to be in Las Vegas restaurants. I mean, that's huge.
Yes, and there's probably some law prohibiting me from mentioning one and not all of them. But, for example, we enjoyed the wine at Jean-Georges Steakhouse at the Aria last night. We were at a new placement for me, Jing, out in the Summerlin area. Just a hoppin' amazing nightclubbish kind of place with a really great wine menu. And those are just 2 of the dozens of beautiful places that have Tierra Roja here in Las Vegas.
Nice. That's great. Now, how many vintages that you, as a winemaker, have you produced?
Well, the 2018 is actually my 15th vintage. Wow.
Yeah.
Where did that time go?
and it's that wine. It's that that Cabernet is just such a great wine. And from this wonderful, was it 4.5 acre property right on Silverado Trail?
Well, the property is 7.5 with just a little less than 5 acres in grapes.
And it's in a pretty darn good neighborhood. You've got some really great, well-known neighbors there.
Yes, I am the unfamous person in the famous neighborhood. So just to one side, Screaming Eagle, Joseph Phelps Bacchus, Rudd, directly above me, Delaval, Minor, just a little bit to the north, to name a few.
Well, you know, the biggest thing we talk about for our listeners is people love to find the smaller wineries. And you're making about how many cases, by the way?
Never more than 250 cases. So this is why they've never heard of me, except on Ray's show.
So many people seek out the smaller producers because the focus and the ability to really baby that wine is such a big deal. I mean, to me, you're kind of a hero in that way versus the 50,000, et cetera, cases.
Well, thank you. I haven't been a hero before, and I'll take it.
So, lots of challenges in Napa, certainly in 20. COVID, fires, you know, not an easy business to be in the wine business.
Tell me a business that is easy these days. Really, everyone is going through the same struggles. You know, our, without getting political, businesses being shut down, hard to get help. It's just tough to muddle through. I think everybody's just doing the best they can.
Right. Any business has its challenges. For you, you have a smaller property, but getting labor, has it been a problem for you?
Well, it's a real problem in the vineyard industry, as it is in all industries. I am very fortunate that I work with a wonderful vineyard manager, farm labor contractor, Ruben Rubio. And it's Ruben's job to find those guys. I just have to maintain a relationship with Ruben. But he has really struggled. A lot of poaching of crews from one company to the next.
Wow.
And wages going through the roof.
And you have competition from legalized pot as well.
That's a big factor. You don't think about it, but it is.
Oh, it's agriculture. It's still part of agriculture. And I'm not trying to get into negatives here, just realities. And of course, you have the big water issue in California. Are you restricted as to what you can and can't do?
In terms of irrigation?
Yes.
Not yet. You know what Mark Twain said, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting over. And nothing has changed in the last 100+ years. And, you know, the day is coming when our groundwater access will be restricted, but we're not there yet. So I irrigate from a well. I don't have surface water where I am. And so far, it's just as long as I can pay the electric bill.
Yeah, that's a big deal, too. Now, you haven't really done any replanting of any major degree on your property, have you, in recent years?
I'm replanting every year. So every single year, I identify any vines that have symptoms of virus and pull them out as quickly as we can identify that so it doesn't spread throughout the vineyard. So I'm replacing generally about 200 vines a year.
Wow.
So it's a very French model, right? Old growth sort of model for replanting. I haven't had a full-scale replanting since 1996.
Nice.
And so that's when the lower vineyard, which was all planted on AXR, as soon as we knew that AXR was going to be susceptible to phylloxera, we actually went in with other rootstocks on the opposite side of the stake, planted them in 96, and then as the AXR vines collapsed, we just cut those away and the next generation flourished.
Oh, wow. That's nice. It's just, to me, such a crazy thing to think about replanting because of the time involved. If there's a definition for a word of a winemaker in my mind, it's patience.
Yes. Well, the other factor is regulations. So I'm on a very steep hillside, and if I were to replant wholesale, just complying with regulations would be time-consuming and expensive. Not impossible, but, you know, millions of dollars just for regulation compliance. So I'm trying to avoid that.
Well, it's not a business for the faint of heart, that's for sure.
No.
But let's get into something positive. You have a new winemaker, which is thrilling to me because I'm a fan, Benoit Touquet, who is a great, hilarious guy, and he makes really, really fantastic wine. So congratulations.
Thank you. I just can't tell you how happy I am. I absolutely love him as a person, and I didn't think it would be possible to elevate our wines to a higher level, and yet I think we're going to do that. So we've just finished our first harvest together. You know, we haven't tasted the wines yet, but just working together so closely for perfect timing of the harvest. Instead of 2 to 3 different days, we had 5 different days of harvest just trying to nail it. And the feedback from Benoit is that we have nailed it. I'm really excited.
That's great. When you have a winemaker like this who works on other projects, is it a comfortable situation to try and get him when you need him? I mean, the grapes will tell you when they're ready to be picked. So how does that work?
I feel like he juggles it all very well. Plus, he's buying the grapes that don't get turned into my wine. So they're going into his own brand.
Oh, nice.
So he's got another vested interest in that. And hopefully you'll see a Faymon Tierra Roja vineyard designate at some point.
I would look forward to that. So, for you as a winemaker, for you as an owner, and you've been in the vineyard business for such a long time, do you have a mentor? Do you have the one person you look up to in the business that, you know, nails it for you?
Well, truthfully, all of my mentors are on the vineyard side because that was my history. And, I can't say that I have anyone that's really a mentor on the wine side except Ren Harris of Paradigm. Ren was somebody that has always been so kind, taken me under his wing, helped even promote me when I first started in the wine business. And I think that part of that is because we knew each other from the farming side. So I would say Ren Harris. Another one who was really a mentor in all things Napa Valley was Robert Mondavi, but of course he's not with us anymore. Talk about a guy that really put everyone ahead of himself. The rising tide floats all boats. On the vineyard side, I'd say it was Bob Steinauer, really looked up to Bob, and still do. He's still with us on the vineyard side,
that's
Bob
good.
Steinauer. And truthfully, my ex-husband, Michael Neal, I really looked up to him for his viticultural capabilities, even though we didn't have any experience together on the wine side. So we could list 100 people that I've looked up to and have helped me.
That's great. And even though you are this very small label, again, you've created this following of people who are very loyal to what you're making because it's an excellent product.
Well, we do really try. I mean, to me, it's very important. When you're going to be small, you better be good in order to get some attention. But I thought when I went on the wine side, to the dark side, we say, when I went to the dark side
yeah.
and started producing wine, I wanted it to be small enough that I would know every single person that was drinking my wine. Well, that turned out to be impossible, even with only 250 cases. But I've made some wonderful friends through this industry. When you're just a farmer, when you're the grower, you'd never meet the people that enjoy the fruits of your labor. So after 20 plus years of being vineyard only, and these last, 15 years of getting on the wine side, it's exciting to meet the people who are enjoying what you produce.
And that's why we're here in Las Vegas, because there'll be a dinner this evening introducing this new vintage as well as tasting these old vintages. And one thing I think is really cool with this tasting tonight, the 2018, some of your library vintages, you'll be pouring some Chapelet, and I'm a big fan of Chapelet as well. That's very cool.
So there's a good story there. As you know, Ray, I was in Morocco, was there a year and a half, and I was supposed to be there 2.5 years. And there was this delightful young couple that lived in my house and ran the business for me while I was in Morocco serving in the Peace Corps, James Lee and Lindsay Gorfine, who just recently got married, by the way.
Oh, congratulations to them.
And Lindsay is the trade liaison for Chapelet.
Oh.
And so I was going to pour a white wine because we're doing 5 vintages of Cabernet, my Cabernet. And there are always some folks that would like to have some white wine. I don't really understand it. So we were going to do a Crocker and Star, Pam Star's girlfriend, and we did her wine once before. But when I found out that James and Lindsay were going to be coming to the dinner tonight, I said, well, can we do a Chapelet wine? And yes, and Chapelet actually donated the case of Chardonnay for our dinner tonight. Isn't that sweet?
That's fantastic. Cyril Chapelet is an awesome man and just a really nice guy. And makes great wine, too, by the way.
By the way.
Yeah, that's fun. And Pam is another very dear friend and certainly a friend of the podcast.
And more great wine.
Yeah, some really good. I got a couple in my cellar, and I just keep looking at them going, should I? I don't know. Anyway, this is kind of an off-the-wall, funny kind of question, but what's the strangest advice you were ever given as a winemaker? That probably goes back to the beginning. Maybe not.
Well, I had a good friend who told me, whatever you do, Linda, do not submit your wines for ratings. She said, you cannot win. If you get a really high rating with your small production, everyone will hate you because you don't have enough. And if you get a poor rating, then, you're really done. So I took this advice to heart. And then when Wine Spectator called and asked me to submit samples of my wine because James Lobby had tried it and loved it and had already written about it, I said, that's so kind of you. Please don't rate me. I've just been told as a small producer that's, could be very, very problematic for me. And thank you so much for your attention. Well, they took it as a huge snub, which was completely unintended.
Sure.
I was brand new in the business. I didn't know anything, right? I didn't know anything about the wine business. And so they wound up buying the wine on their own and giving me a very poor rating, even though I knew that they had already expressed that they loved the wine. So that was very terrible advice, and that was, you know, strange advice, and now I know, but I didn't know then.
Do you submit at all these days or no?
If anybody asks me, how much do you want?
Yeah, really.
Who are you? I don't care.
Yeah, right. I'm there. I'm on the way. It's a challenge. I think it's a challenge for wine lovers when you see the ratings, and that gets into personal opinions that I won't get into myself, but it does create this odd situation.
The other really bad advice, everybody said, don't get a distributor. You know, all they do is take half the money and they don't do anything for it. And that's true for a lot of them, I'm sure. But I have two really fantastic distributors that make the industry so joyful. My guy here in Las Vegas, Harley Nichols, and Greg and Kelly Zempel out in Virginia. Not only do they do a great job of placing my wine, but they bring joy to the industry for me. So that was another bad bit of advice.
It's nice to hear that. For you in 2020, any ill effects of the fires at all?
Sadly, yes. So there will be no 2020 vintage of Tierra Roja. We were doing fresh fruit samples, trying to determine if we were affected by smoke taint. And in the fresh fruit samples, we never did get it. But the turnaround was so slow, the turnaround because of the demand. It's like 3 weeks. So it was a moving target. We finally, by we, I mean my winemaker at that time, Jeff Ames and Tor Kenward, Tor really wanted to make a Tierra Roja vintage. And, you know, the winemaker was understandably not wanting to do that.
Sure.
But we went ahead and picked it. But by the time we harvested, it was like 34 bricks. It was,
wow.
It was really over the top, just trying to gather more information that just wasn't there. Finally pulled the trigger, harvested, went all the way through fermentation, and then the smoke taint characteristics were revealed. The interesting thing about the smoke taint characteristics, they're largely masked by sugar. Well, once you've converted all of the sugar into alcohol, then you can see them. So even though the one of those measuring sticks was below a detectable level and the other was barely detectable level, we decided, and I agreed, to not produce any Tierra Roja wine, and it wound up being made into hand sanitizer.
How does wine get turned into hand sanitizer?
The guy that hauls it away for free distills it and makes it into hand sanitizer.
My heart is breaking.
Yeah, and, you know, ours was not the only one. You will have a hard time finding a high-end brand. You know, it doesn't even have to be a cult wine, you know, just a high-end brand from 2020. But most of those grapes will have been processed into something. Yeah. So, for example, you know, Doug Schaefer was the first one to send out a notice to all of his buyers that we are not going to produce a 2020 because we don't feel that we can trust that it will be a top-notch product. And most people followed suit on that. Who wants to be the one that doesn't deliver the top-notch product, right?
Not me.
But most wineries that own all their facilities, own the grapes, they weren't going to buy grapes from any growers. A lot of them were going to take their own stuff and see what they could do with it. But it'll probably come out in a declassified under some other label in a cheaper product. There'll be wines out there from 2020. And then, of course, just because it was a problem year in Napa Valley doesn't mean it was a problem year in Paso Robles. There'll still be a lot of delicious 2020 wines out there, I'm sure.
Are there legal ramifications for wineries? Like, for example, Doug Schaefer not selling his grapes? Does he run into a situation where somebody says, no, I want those? Or is that up to him? I don't know how the contract...
Well, I think he's all internal, right? So he can do whatever he wants with his own grapes. Now, if, for example, when I was selling grapes to Tor Kenward, it was really 100% up to him. My only decision was whether I wanted to make my own brand. So, but he chose not to as well. So it just depends on the relationship.
Sure.
It's a funny question to ask a lot of winemakers. Are you in a tasting group at all? Do you do any standard tasting with people just to see what's out there, or you just kind of do your own solo thing?
No, I think winemakers, yes, because that's what they do. But I am a farmer that just happens to have a little wine brand, and I'm not in a tasting group. I was in a tasting group with a bunch of women, Wine Entre Femmes, for a while, and that was fun. I enjoyed it, but not at this time.
I remember that group. Is that group still active at all? Or?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, we've talked about this in the past, but just maybe to refresh some of our listeners' memory about where you came from. You're a native Californian.
Yes.
And you are a farmer. That's where you came from. You've got dirt under your fingernail somewhere.
I covered it with paint.
When did you make that transition into the vineyard management business? Because that's basically how you started in wine, correct?
Right. So I actually first came to work in the Napa Valley as a crop consultant, pest control advisor, working for a French company called Rhone Polonc. And we manufactured a botryticide. And this was part of my territory. I had all of Northern California, Nevada, and Utah, actually, for a variety of products. But began working with grape growers in the Napa Valley back in 1981 with them, and worked for them until 1986. And in 1986, that company went through a big merger, and I had to choose between staying in the Napa Valley or staying with that company. And in the meanwhile, I had married a vineyard manager, and my life was very importantly in the Napa Valley now. So I chose to stay with him instead of the ag chemical company, and we started our own vineyard management company. And so that was back in 1987. So in 1987, bought the vineyard property and primarily worked for other people and grew that up to where we were farming about 1,000 acres here in the Napa Valley as M&L Vineyard Management Company.
That's a lot of acreage.
Yes, and it was very busy time and very fun. And then our story is a sad one, as so many people, we divorced. And so when we divorced, I was no longer in the vineyard management business, but now I have this tiny little vineyard, and decided to do one of the things that it always talked about doing, and that was having a little wine brand. So that's how Tierra Roja was born, and now I'm in the wine business, and I still farm my tiny little vineyard, but nothing commercially for other people. And as you know, I had the second property up in the Sierra foothills.
Right.
And had that wine brand and that little tasting room and winery, and did that for, 10 years of the tasting room, and then sold that in 2018, and now it's just Tierra Roja.
Which is very nice. And as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, the name of the property was Tierra Roja, right? That's how you got the name of the wine itself.
Well, it was named so by the workers that worked for us in the vineyard management company. They had a Spanish nickname for all of the properties that we took care of, and the home property had two names, Casa de Linda, or Rancho de la Tierra Roja, because of this blazing terracotta red soil that you could really see when we cut the terraces back in 89. And that name stuck.
Nice. It's a good name. I like how it just stands out well. My favorite question to ask winemakers, and I don't think, we've interviewed you a number of times over the years, which is always great fun, but I don't think I've asked you this question, and you could think about it. For all the times you've done media and you've been interviewed, what is the one question that you've not been asked that you would like to be asked?
Will you go with me to dinner tonight?
Yes.
I just look at a media opportunity as a wonderful way to answer other people's questions. And I know that if you're good at media, you have a preset list of things you want to say, and you're trying to get that information out. And I'm just not that polished, I guess, Ray. But I just I guess the message that I want to get out, we kind of touched on earlier, is that it's very personal for me, and I look forward to actually talking with people that drink my wine. And so just do I enjoy getting calls and emails and texts from people when they're enjoying my wine? I really do. So there you go.
What a compliment. I think just to get that question to people saying, can you tell me something about this, or give me a little background or something? It's a lot of fun.
It is fun. It should be fun. This is a wine business. If you can't have fun doing the wine business, poor you.
Yeah, that would be really sad. That's why people are happy in the wine business.
And so even in our worst years, right, whether if the crop dries up or you don't have irrigation water or, you know, smoke taint takes your crop away, even in our worst days, we have it better than 99% of the people on the planet. We live in a beautiful place. We are working with nature. We have wonderful friends that we meet over a glass of wine. So even on my most boohoo moments, it's still pretty great.
It's not bad. Linda, for our listeners who would like to learn about Tierra Roja and about Linda Neal, what is your website?
Well, it's pretty easy. It's www.tierraroja.com.
I'm looking forward to tonight, and I'm so happy to see you after all this time. Thank you for getting together here at the hotel.
No, are you kidding? Thank you.
Learn more by visiting tierraroja.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2021.